Great.
And yeah, just want to also remind folks, go ahead, raise your hands. You're going to have an opportunity to ask Professor Salzman some questions. And as always, I would very much personally appreciate it if you'd share the room, if you're enjoying it. So thank you. Richard.
Great. Thank you, Jen. And thank you all for joining. I'm going to talk today about what might seem like a paradox, MBAs against capitalism. Now, MBAs are those who go to business school and get a master's in business administration. First thing to think about, by the way, is the A. Administration sounds very boring. Why would it be ideological? The reason is MBAs, which is a fairly new phenomenon in America. Business schools themselves were started about 100 years ago. But they tend to generate CEOs at large companies. So the whole point of training business people for broad management skills is that these are usually big companies. So the first thing to keep in mind is they are training future managers of large enterprises. And I've said in the past in prior presentations about the woke movement, the movement toward the stakeholder view, the movement toward a big business as both distrusted but able to absolve its sins if it serves the broader community and the world and the planet and things like that. There is a difference, a noticeable difference between CEOs of large companies and presidents and entrepreneurs of smaller companies. The bigger ones tend to be more anti-capitalist. And my theme today, really, and I'll stop as I usually do about 25 minutes into this, is that business is not, and business schools are not, immune from the broader philosophic trends going on in the universities. So critical race theory, for example, we know, and other things came out of the law schools. So business schools, especially to the extent they teach business ethics, are not, as some people think on the outside, inherently pro-business. That may sound weird, but particularly are not pro-capitalist. And I'll say a little more about that, but just to give some background, just to give you a sense of just some headlines, just some recent articles by business school professors and other observers on this. I go back only about 10 years. In a symposium on the fortunes of capitalism, a professor, Peter Lorenzi, Business Schools, Capitalism's Last Stand. Now, notice that. That's from Society, the Journal of Society. That everyone's against capitalism and the only holdouts must be in the business schools. Now, here's one from 2016, Harvard Business Review, from Nick Torres. Quote, MBAs are more self-serving than other CEOs. Unquote. This is an interview of a researcher, Dan Miller, who studied 444 CEOs over many decades and looked at their performance and found that those and distinguished those that had MBAs and those that didn't have MBAs. And according to Miller, the ones with MBAs performed badly and engaged in self-serving behavior that benefited themselves but hurt their companies. Fast forward a little bit now, 2018, from a podcast called Capital Isn't. It's not capitalism, Capital Isn't, by an egalitarian, Zingales and Bethany McLean. The Moral Case Against the MBA. Now here they're interviewing Duff McDonald, who had just written a book called The Golden Passport, The Limits of Capitalism and the Moral Failure of the MBA Elite. And now get that, the moral failure. Now, from that interview, the author said, quote, MBAs and CEOs have dropped the ball. I fall into the camp that says the purpose of a corporation is to give us a way to work communally, to achieve our communal objectives. The system we have today that came about in the 80s and 90s and instead was tilted toward the shareholder in an obscene, an unfair and unsustainable way, unquote. So the shareholder, if you know from my prior podcast, the shareholder owns the company. And it's an obscene thing, she says, for managers of corporations to work for the owners They have to work for the community. That is the new God, society, the secular God. Now, here's the Harvard Crimson, 2019. Quote, this is the headline. Lack of trust in the capitalist system is Harvard Business School's biggest challenge, says Dean, unquote. Well, you can just imagine what that one was. The Dean of the Harvard Business School is saying, wow, it's a real challenge here. There's a lack of trust in the capitalist system when we're producing future capitalists. So part of this story is to tout a new course at the business school called Reimagining Capitalism. You can imagine what the reimagining is. It's basically to get rid of it. Now, here's Glenn Hubbard. Glenn Hubbard is a prominent economist, is head of the Columbia Business School now, has taught there for many years, served in many administrations, I think served in the Bush administration, Bush W. This is in the Atlantic, January of this year. Quote, this is the title of the Atlantic by Hubbard. Even business school students have doubts about cap, unquote. Next, he reports on this and sees a trend over the years and claims to be surprised about this, perplexed. And the essence of the essay is that, well, you know, I teach them how profitable and efficient and productive this capitalist system is, and they don't seem swayed in the least. They seem to be very perturbed about its unequal results. That capitalism's benefits should be more evenly distributed. So Hubbard doesn't even question any of this. He's just thinking, wow, now I'm in business school. I'm not supposed to be dealing with ethics and morals and politics and stuff like that. I don't know what hit me. But I think even the phrase, even my business school students, is interesting. Why should they be different, Glenn Hubbard? And then Washington Post just last week. Alison Schrager, quote, America's MBAs are the latest skeptics of capitalism, somewhat referring to Hubbard's piece, but also elaborating. Now, just on the couple of things about this seeming paradox. You may not know this, but it was a premise of Marx, and it's still latent almost everywhere. Marx, from the mid-1800s, had the view that your economic position determined your ideas. The relationship you had to the means of production determine your ideology. And so from that, it felt, and also there's antagonism, of course, in his economics, he said there's an inherent antagonism between labor and management. The management, the capitalists, not the manual laborers, not the ones getting their hands dirty, not the ones with blue collars on, but white collars on. Exploit the quote-unquote real workers. And so there's an inherent antagonism. But the idea was, if you're a capitalist, you're pro-capitalist ideologically. If you have, in other words, your bank account, so to speak, your financial status determines. And if you're a worker who's being exploited, you're anti-capitalist. So today's phenomenon would be completely incomprehensible to Marx if he saw someone like George Soros or Bill Gates, multi-billionaires who are anti-capitalists, and then they see a truck driver or a waiter at the local diner who's, pro-Trump or something like that, pro-capitalist. That just doesn't fit their model. But it's relevant here because of all the people coming out of the universities, what would that premise lead people to think? That, maybe sociology departments, maybe poli-sci departments would produce anti-capitalists. But certainly less so econ. Lots of essays out there. Are econ students inherently more selfish than other students, because they're taught about the economic system? But certainly in the business schools, where it's not just economics, but running it business enterprises, there the idea is, well, they must be in favor ideologically of the system that they're working in. And that just isn't true. It just isn't true, but I'm trying to explain why this phenomenon exists. Now, another reason I wanted to speak about this is when we speak separately about the phenomenon, as I have in the past, of woke CEOs who are not focused on working for shareholders, maximizing profits, maximizing shareholder value, the stock price, things like that. This is one of the reasons. One of the reasons is the business schools themselves have become infected with anti-capitalist and particularly anti-egoist ideas. Now, in business school, I went to business school in the mid-80s at New York University. So I got my MBA. And typically, if you know, if you get an MBA, you specialize either within the MBA, you specialize in some in either, well, management is one thing. But obviously, things like marketing or finance or manufacturing, which is less common, accounting. But they would, I remember at the time, you had to take a course, besides all those more business-oriented ones, you had to take a course called The Legal and Social Context of Business. The Legal and Social Context of Business. And I remember, you know, the idea was, well, it isn't enough just to manage your enterprise. You future professional business people are going to climb up the ranks. You're going to have to know how to deal with legal matters. Well, obviously, but more than what they really meant was regulation and government and things like. Now, in the mid 80s, the U.S. was moving toward capitalism. It was moving toward deregulation in Britain as well. So the Reagan-Thatcher revolution of the 80s and 90s, I was going to business school in an age when things were freeing up and we were not taught how to handle, you know, massive government interventions in the economy, which have happened since. And I was particularly in banking at the time. I was at the Bank of New York on Wall Street. So had I even imagined, if someone had told me, you know, by 2008, big bank bailouts, by 2020, the government would be basically taking over the banking system. I'm not sure I would have believed it. But as a result, you can imagine what's being taught in business schools, how much different it would be, not you know, in 2005, let alone in 1985 when I went. This is where the woke CEO things come. Now, if I'm right, there's a lag, of course. If you're an MBA who starts small in a business, it takes, you know, it could take 20 years to get to the corporate suite. So the CEOs we're seeing now came out of the business school, say, roughly 20 years ago. That would be, you know, 2002, so even before the financial crisis. And you can imagine the ones being trained now, if things don't change, it's going to be pretty bad. These CEOs are going to get worse and worse and worse. And they're going to, by that I mean, they're going to more and more be willing, eagerly, unapologetically, unabashedly to sacrifice the interests of the owners of companies and serve their masters on K Street and in Washington and at the woke forums in Switzerland and everywhere else. So they're moving. I've done this separately. The stakeholder model of capitalism is being taught in the business schools. Your job is not to serve shareholders, or they're, you know, that's one of the constituents, but let's severely diminish that role. There's a constellation of others you must be serving, a concatenation of others, like a government and workers and employees, and then workers and employees and customers. Come on, I mean, companies have already for years had a self-interest in those because they can make money, which is fine. And so the sanctimonious posturing of those who say, well, corporations today should really, you know, spend time making sure their customers and their employees and their suppliers are happy. Obviously, they've been doing that. There's nothing incompatible with that motive. No, really, the motive here is to go beyond that to people who have nothing to do with the corporation, don't own the corporation, but want to control it. So this is like backdoor Marxism. Instead of seizing the means of production, instead of laborers rising up as they didn't do to seize the means of production because they were so pissed off, here's the argument is, let's set up a model where everybody takes over the corporation. It's like the Lilliputians taking over the giant, you know, a bunch of small little cuts and just eat the corporation alive. And then even better, train a whole cadre of future CEOs who will do it from within, who from within won't even be fighting this model and unabashedly adulterating the fiduciary duty, in a good sense, by the way, the fiduciary duty. If you're holding assets in trust and you have been hired to preserve and grow those assets, it's an irresponsible violation. It's almost criminal that you dissipate the assets. And that's what these corporations are being told to do. And they're being applauded for it. No one is criticizing them for basically turning their attentions away from the actual owners of the company. Now, if business ethics is not going to be substantially different than regular old ethics, you're going to have things like we've had money is the root of all evil, or as Marx taught, profit is theft. I mean, built into these old concepts are that the very thing that business pursues is vicious, is evil. And the only justification they can give is not a self-interested one, but a collectivist altruist one. At least we're serving society. At least we're serving the broader community. And if we aren't found serving the broader community, then we're guilty. Guilty is charged. Let's be taken over. Let's be told what to do. They won't seize the means of production necessarily. We'll just be told what to do, and we'll agree wholeheartedly that's the fascist model. Now, another example of this would be prices are set arbitrarily. We're seeing that today. Why are gas prices going up? Putin did it. Why are gas prices coming up? Yeah, Exxon is profiteering. Shell is price gouging. There's a premise out there that prices are not set by supply and demand, by the law of supply and demand. They're set by greedy bastards. And when prices are low and they're not going anywhere, allegedly these greedy bastards are being altruistic. And then they rise up every once in a while and become more greedy. I mean, it's just so cartoonish and so ridiculous, but there it is. But another one you see is, this is kind of an old one, but I'll just throw it out there, advertising and commercialization and commodification. It's all lying, cheating, manipulation, stealing. Couple of other quotes on CEOs. This really tops it off, and I could discuss other things, but we focus here on CEOs. Forbes magazine, 2019, the psychopathic CEO. If you just Google CEOs are sociopaths, just Google, I hope you would be shocked to see hundreds of articles and essays about that. Some of them, you know, repetitive because they're leveraging off of and summarizing journal articles. But these aren't just journalistic. These are academic journal articles, either from psychology journals or social behavior journals. And one after another, you can see the bigotry. You can see the bias. You know, since these people are pursuing the profit motive, this is kind of the logic. And since the profit motive is a commercial manifestation of self-interest, it must be evil. It must lead to terrible results. So studies have allegedly shown that CEOs, now not just MBA CEOs, this is just CEOs, are psychopaths. Another one from Forbes magazine. Senior executives are more likely to be psychopaths. There's another essay here where they're debating whether they're psychopaths or sociopaths. So there's a distinction to be made. CNBC, that's a business network. 1 in 5 business leaders are psychopaths. Here's why. Now, by the way, when you dig down and say, what are they talking about? Are we missing the mass murderers or apparently CEOs running around? They literally will say things like aggressive and you're competitive and, you know, rose up the ladder quickly. And you shake your head as to why would that be psychopathic? But there you go. Fortune magazine 2021, psychopaths in corporate leadership. It's time to take it seriously. Business Insider 2017. Here's why CEOs often have the traits of a psychopath. You get the idea. I just want to tout something I wrote about 7 years ago, very relevant to this, and one way of interpreting all this craziness. I wrote something called Common Caricatures of Self-Interest and Their Common Source. That's in Reason Papers 2015. Common Caricatures of Self-Interest. Now, these characters, caricatures, these kind of cartoonish, distorted presentations of self-interest definitely run right to the business student and the business, the MBA and the future CEO. And among the things I named were that to be self-interested is to be atomistic, you know, not care about anyone else, just be all alone by yourself, or to be myopic, just short range of the moment. You'd lie, cheat, and steal, you know, to get quarterly profits. Sadistic, antagonistic. Another one is automatic. You know, it's assumed that people are automatically self-interested. They don't even have a choice in the matter. That wouldn't be a moral issue, but that's not true either. We know that people have to learn how to be self-interested and rationally pursue it. The common source I pointed out for these caricatures is a lack of reason. On every level, if you ever come across a kind of outlandish, over-the-top, cartoonish characterization of what self-interested behavior would be, look, if you look very closely, it's not rational. It literally is not rational. It's not behavior where people are thinking through who else they might deal with, thinking through their reputation, thinking longer range, realizing that their self-interest is maximized by being long range, not short range, all those kind of things. That solves it to some degree. Now, I just want to leave on a somewhat a positive note. There are a couple of objectivist books, or I should say books by objectivists, particularly on business and on profit and the moral aspects of this. And they're really very good, and they're fairly recent too. So the first one is by Robert White. So I highly recommend it. The Moral Case for Profit Maximization. The Moral Case for Profit Maximization. That was 2020, so that's fairly recent. And another really good one, Yana Wosession, I'll spell it. How to Be Profitable and Moral, a Rational Egoist Approach to Business. So Yana taught for many years at the University of Calgary Business School, long-term objectivist, very good. Her last name, Wosession, Wosession, Yana, Jaana, very good. And also, if you get access to articles in journals and elsewhere, and she has a website as well, as so you can look through that. So that's all I'm going to say right now. I think I sum it up by saying, for those looking for the tributaries into woke corporations today, the anti-capitalist angle of large corporations today, one source of this is business schools and getting an MBA. And no one should think that business schools are necessarily pro-business. I mean, I'm not saying they're, you know, virulently anti-business. To the extent they actually teach business skills and management skills, they are thankfully contributing to a cadre of actual professional managers, which large corporations need, importantly. But the problem is, the real big problem is the moral and political stuff they're being taught. And again, the moral political thing being, you should question self-interest. You should be serving the broader community. You should not be focused on serving and working for the owners of the company who hired you, the shareholders. And more than that, you should be, and again, this is what's being taught in business, you should be deferential to state officials who are trying to take over your business. Well, not your business, the business of your owners. Be deferential to government intervention. Don't fight back on government intervention. Find ways to accommodate the statists coming at you. Find ways to appease and fund, if necessary, things like Black Lives Matter or things like the World Economic Forum. Actually use corporate resources to feed the parasites who are trying to eat the corporations alive. This is what's going on. It's very troubling. There are ways to fight back, but that's really all I wanted to talk about today. One last thing. It's a very funny thing. It's a very funny essay I found from a professor at DePaul in Chicago, Daryl Cohn, a woman, Daryl Cohn. And it's called, Is Business Ethics an Oxymoron? Yeah, and she says, quote, I've taught business ethics for 10 years, and I'd be a rich woman today if I had a dollar for everyone who said to me, business ethics? Isn't that a contradiction in terms? Ha ha ha. Sometimes business people make this comment, but more often the skeptics are people outside of business. She goes on, now this isn't, she's not so bad. She basically says, it's pretty bad, but she basically says corporations and managers should serve the community. So she's not one of these people who want to tear the corporation down and burn it to the ground. But that's another way of looking at this. The very fact that that would be a common refrain, that that would be a common comment to anyone who even uses the word business ethics. And what is it really? It's ethics is altruism. That's just, they just think of that's what ethics is. You're supposed to serve others. And business, wait a minute, business is profit maximization and the profit motive. And that sounds selfish. That sounds egoistic. So you can see why they would think there's an oxymoron, but only because they think self-interest is not moral. Okay, I'll stop.
All right. Excellent. I've seen a couple people raising your hands. Go ahead, raise your hands. We'll bring you up on stage. But David or Roger, did you have anything that you wanted to ask or reflections on what Richard just shared?
Go ahead, David.
I have a quick one, I think, hopefully a quick one. What you're saying is even more depressing than I realized, and I've read some of these things, but not the more recent things you're citing. But I'm also aware that, I'm thinking about Andrew Carnegie's Gospel of Wealth in the late 19th century, where, you know, he said, in effect, that, actually have a quote here, surplus wealth is a sacred trust which its possessor is bound to administer in his lifetime for the good of the community. And so he's giving away the moral game there right from the start. And that's been true. So, I mean, this altruism business is questionable because of altruism, and it has to be discharged. We have to launder our wealth by giving it away. Goes back a long way. The difference is, I guess, that in his era, the outlet for that was private philanthropy, which at least is voluntary and, it can be handled and set up things like the Carnegie Foundation with some rules and some degree of rationality in what they do. But as opposed to now, what you've been describing is a lot of people who say, you know, the state is should be the object, should be the controller and the recipient of that gospel of wealth, the wealth that Carnegie was talking about. Is that, I'm just wondering, this the moral issue seems to go back a long, long way, as if the capitalism and the entire industrial revolution took place without anyone thinking about the morality or changing their views about the morality. But it has, we've gone from a state of private philanthropy to government regulation, government control of corporations and so forth. Is there something that will explain that that change from the private to the, you know, state control?
Well, that's a good point, David. And I know what you're talking about. And I think the major difference, well, let's say what's similar, first of all, the Carnegie approach of justifying wealth creation. And by the way, the issue is not really wealth creation. What they really resent is wealth accumulation, the building up of wealth, right? Then you start getting estates and inequality. But the difference is, I would say this, Carnegie makes his own wealth. There is no question that in the making and in the living years, so to speak, it's all self-interested and it's all, you know, serve the shareholder, whether it's himself or his share. And here the argument is, but when you die and before you die, give your stuff away. Yeah, first to family, but then libraries. And yeah, so the whole thing, the Carnegie Hall and Carnegie Libraries, there the idea was not mixing the two. It was like two realms. I'm alive, and now I'm self-interested in profit-seeking, and I'm accumulating wealth. But now I'm about to die, and I shouldn't just give it all to my kids. That would be selfish. Give it to the community. The difference today is they're basically saying, while you're making it, give it away. Or they're actually saying, don't make so much. Don't maximize profit. They're telling corporations, see what I'm saying? They're not saying to corporations, make a boatload of money, but make sure in your will or when you leave as CEO or whatever, you know, however you want to put it. No, the issue now is, no, you must be doing this while you're working, and you must be working every day, not to the accumulation of wealth for the benefit of the owners, but for all the reasons I said, all the non-owners and stuff like that. And certainly the idea of don't maximize profit, they're not only not saying don't maximize profit and then give it away when you die, they're saying don't maximize profit now while you're managing the company, do it now. So I think that's a major difference, David, although if you want to look for a counterpart of Carnegie in the current context, there is something called the Giving Pledge. If you look up the Giving Pledge, this was something done, I think, more than 10 years ago. Ted Turner, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, and other billionaires got together, coordinated this. They got together and said, you know, I think Oprah Winfrey was in there as well, David Rockefeller, and they were making a commitment to do what Carnegie said should be done. And the argument was not enough were, you know, and the idea was they were trying to embarrass people into, hey, billionaire, you're not in the giving pledge, or what? How selfish of you, aren't you committing to give it away to, now that was actually kind of like old-fashioned Carnegie type approach. And, right. And that is, you know, that is so passe now. That is just nothing. That today, all those people, if you think about who I named, Buffett, Oprah Winfrey, Ted Turner, all those people, while they were rising up in their careers, they would have been stripped alive, you know, and not being able to accumulate their wealth. So that's the distinction I would make. I hope it's. I don't think the distinction is it used to be we gave this away voluntarily and then we shifted into the state taxed us to death and gave it away itself. That obviously did happen, but what I'm focused on here is what are business people actually being taught to do, and what are they being convinced is moral, and that is a big shift, I think.
So, could we is an aspect of that used to be we collectivized the product when you know, of great wealth, we collectivized the result, and now they're talking about collectivizing the process.
No, that's a good distinction. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Okay, the moral, that's great. Thank you. That's a big difference.
I have to think about that a little more, David. That's good. Yeah. I mean, okay. People know that in the 40s and 50s, the other big phrase was corporate social responsibility. So that was the beginnings of what we're seeing now. And then it was just, I mean, then it was just something as simple as don't be irresponsible. Don't, you know, pollute the local river, or, you know, don't, whatever, use your munitions to start wars and stuff like that. So that was more, but now it's, no, you must sacrifice the company to all these others. And that's what the whole ESG thing is. If you look up ESG, these companies are making ESG pledges, environmental, social, governance. The SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, now is forcing companies to spend millions of dollars reporting on their, you know, carbon footprint, reporting on how they're contributing to social justice movement and stuff like that, and putting it in their financial reports for monitoring. And so that's how extensive it's becoming. Friedman, the great free market economist, Milton Friedman, in 1970 in the New York Times, famously defended the corporate shareholder model by saying the social responsibility of business is to maximize profits. And if you just look that up, the Friedman shareholder model, that has been denounced and criticized and rejected, especially when there was a 50th anniversary of it in 2020. There was a string of articles, almost none of which defended that model, called the shareholder model, all of them denouncing it, and many of them MBAs, business students, CEOs denouncing it.
All right. Wow. Thanks, Richard.
Okay.
Thanks. Roger.
Yeah, no, thanks for this room. You give me flashbacks of when I was in corporate America and just suffering through policies that just didn't make sense. Once upon a time, like early in my career, people that were very philanthropic would they would want to advance their career, make more money, so they could then use that excess money to to do the things that they wanted to do, whether it was in their community or whatever special interest that might be. And they understood that you had to do the work, you had to bring the value, and then you could take the excess from that and go do what you want to do. And in this model where corporations are pandering to a certain culture, they will set up things like where they will match funds. So if an employee wants to give to a particular nonprofit, they will submit that to a committee that would then review that and then release matching company funds into those charities, which was supposed to encourage people to give more into their community. The problem was the gatekeeping on which ones you could do. I can tell you just a couple off the top that I tried to give to with matching funds, and that was, oh, which is Young Americans for Liberty. That was rejected. Oh, we can't give to political, and then 10th Amendment Center, which for the same reason. So a politically motivated thing was shot down, but yet I guarantee that majority of the things that they were funding had a political bent as well. So it's very interesting how they gatekeep these things. And then the other part of it is when the company starts struggling and they're having bad quarters and health, and you're doing things like shutting down business units and cost-cutting measures, they'll keep those programs alive to where even at a company-wide meeting, when somebody suggests, hey, maybe we should cut that particular program that's giving money to these philanthropic things. Maybe we should suspend that until we become more profitable. No, we're never getting rid of that program. Okay, excellent. So you could profitable, but you can't possibly get rid of this program that makes you check that box that you're doing your civic duty. Anyways, I'm glad you're doing this room. It's very interesting.
Thank you. Thank you, Raji. A couple of things. The idea that the corporation's matching funds for various philanthropies, charities, the argument would be that is not the purpose of the corporation. Suppose it's a bank. The corporation, they should be making loans and cash management services and maximizing profit. I think what's happened is they look at it as an employee benefit. And the employees will say, well, I want to give to this cause. And they'll say, good, we'll do matching funds. And then if one company does it and the other one doesn't, well, the other company does matching funds. Are you going to do matching funds? And so these businesses, aside from the moral corruption, it should be understood that business people, they're not the only ones, but they tend to be prone to pragmatism, the philosophy that says there are no principles, that you make it up as you go. In Harvard, they have like the case study method. They for decades they've had this. The idea, one case after another, see if you can figure out what the pattern is. No, less focus on principles and more on try something, see if it works. If it doesn't work, try something else. So that kind of mentality doesn't help either. But a real source of this corruption is HR departments. Now, if you run a small business, you just hire people. The owner will hire people or have some other people interview them. Once you get up into the thousands of employees, there are, if you know, in the corporate world, I was at Citicorp for many years. There's just huge managerial issues associated with HR, hiring people, promoting them. And they're just, when you think about it, they are outposts of government agencies, that are the Department of Labor, all the agencies, purportedly trying to prevent injustice and bigotry in hiring and things like that. So the HR departments become, it isn't just the CEO suites, the HR, the human resource departments become a source of real anti-corporate stuff. and increasingly more recently training pro. Can you imagine the training programs of existing employees where they just hound these employees and put them through sensitivity training and anti-racial this and anti-racial that, just on a total widespread presumption of guilt. Not presumption of innocence, not some employees acted badly. Just assume all the employees are racist or sexist or homophobes or Islamophobes and run them through trainings. Just the sheer injustice of that, let alone the waste of doing things other than your work. The other thing that you might be aware of, there's something called effective altruism. Really a perverse thing when you think about it. Altruism itself is either a non-ethic to me or anti-ethic. The idea that the only thing that's moral is serving others. And more specifically, it can't be others you value. It has to be others that are of no value to you, or maybe even your enemies. Turn the other cheek. Effective altruism was a movement. If you just look it up, there's whole websites on this. Effective altruism was the idea that, well, wait a minute, Mother Teresa really isn't doing much because she's as poor as dirt. And when she goes out and helps people and washes their feet, she can only do so much. So the effective altruist, they argue, should go to Wall Street, make a fortune, and then give it to left-wing causes. And you should not go to Wall Street or make a fortune because you enjoy that work. No, you should be slavish about it. You're toiling away. You're maybe even burning out. But you spend about a decade and amass a fortune and then give it to BLM or give it to Antifa. Or give it to the Democratic Party, or give it to some anti-corporate group. And that's called effective altruism, where it's only effective if you amass wealth and use your wealth to be anti-wealth. That's the kind of stuff that's going on.
All right. Clark, are you with us?
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Yeah, it's great. Listen, great presentation, as usual, Richard. And the only thing I wanted to maybe add is, I've never worked on Wall Street, and of course you have, and I've always just assumed that the people on Wall Street who aren't familiar with Rand's ideas fall into, one of three camps. Either they feel like, hey, we want to be like Gordon Gekko or Michael Milken. I mean, even though we all know that Milken, with his high-yield bonds, actually produced a highly practical and effective program, but most people, I assume, in the business world, don't want to be Gordon Gekko, or, the other, I guess, second camp would be people who, who are amoral, who feel like you were explaining earlier, it's like, let's build our business, let's become successful in the business world first, then we'll figure out a way how to somehow smuggle morality back into our life. Somehow morality to them, of course, is exogenous to their, 9 to 5 or 8 to 5 daily life. And then again, the third group, of course, are the ones, the woke people, the ones who, who want stakeholder capitalism. And, if those are the only three choices, of course, then maybe we shouldn't be too surprised that all this wokeism has arisen. I guess most people who aren't objectivists, they want to be moral. They want to feel moral. They don't want to go through life, amoral. So when faced with those three choices, I mean, obviously, they don't consider Rand's ethics as an alternative. Then that's what you're going to get. And just if I could piggyback this on what you had said earlier about this, Marx's economic determinism. Unfortunately, as I'm sure you're aware, there's a lot of libertarians who are not socialist, but they seem to have the same view that it's all corruption, and the people who've made it big have all sold out, to the state, or to this wokeism. And when in fact, I think pretty much everyone in this room believes that most of these big people, like Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, the other names you mentioned earlier, they really do believe this woke stuff. They really do believe in ESG and corporate social responsibility. So it's unfortunate, that there's so many people who are really I guess you could call them capitalists, but you know, it's all, you know, follow the money, you know, qui bono, who benefits. It's not follow the ideas, which is what we hold. So I guess I'd like to hear your thoughts on this.
Well, there's a phenomenon. Thank you for that. The Wall Street comment made me think this might interest you. That when the phenomenon I have noticed is, imagine going up the what's called the structure of production, and you had a job or knew some company or CEOs inside kind of mining and extraction industries, you know, like oil and gas development. Then up from that, manufacturing, and then up from that, say, retailing. And then up from that, advertising, finance, business consulting. If you think about it, for most people, they think of, well, the first one's kind of in the dirt, in the extractive, they're taking stuff out of the earth. But all the way up to finance and consulting, a very abstract, highly abstract. What really happens is they think the further you go up that chain, the more parasitical you are. That is the Marxist theory. Even if it's a CEO, I'm not talking about just workers. I mean, CEOs in these sectors, you will find that when they're in manufacturing, they're not as anti-capitalist. When they're in retailing, a little less so, but they get up into advertising, finance, consulting. It's interesting that the more abstract work, and it's not as if they're not productive at those jobs. It's that they come with, because they're more intelligent, actually, and because they went to elite schools, they tend to be more, they tend to reflect more what the prevailing ideology is. So that's why you see consulting firms, you know, McKinsey and Booz Allen and others, and finance, you see all the major bankers, very rare exceptions where they would be pro-capitalist. That's the reason. But it's a head scratcher to most people because they think the more abstract the work and the more money oriented it is, they must be pro-capitalist, and it's actually the complete reverse. It's as you go down the chain of business sectors to ones that are more granular, so to speak, and on the ground, that they're less hostile to capitalism. So I don't know. That's just a different take on things. I hope that helps. My experience on Wall Street, I must say, when I first went down there, I was becoming a capitalist and an objectivist in the late 70s, and I went to Wall Street in 81. And so I did not expect to find a bunch of pro-capitalists, but even I was shocked at how many people in finance I met who were anti-capitalist. They just were. They were promoting, you know, they were anti-Reagan, whoever ran against Reagan. They were for Carter. They were for Mondale. They were for, I can't even remember all the goofballs that ran against, invariably. If you ask them, many times they would just say they felt guilty. So precisely their success, they'd say, someone would say, you know, I'm making a fortune in foreign exchange and I don't really think I'm productive, but it's fascinating work and it's, you know, taxes my skills and stuff like that. But they literally thought them, they had been convinced that what they were doing, especially in finance, was not a productive addition to the economy. I consider it actually the most productive, one of the most productive sectors, but that's not what they're taught. They're taught in business school that they're just shuffling paper and they're just moving money around and they're not really adding value. And yet they're better paid than most others. So the gap between the two, what am I doing and what am I making, is huge. And it makes them feel, and they're taught to feel very guilty about it. This is very much of a shame. Oh, by the way, just an example of how craven these companies are. I don't know if you guys noticed recently, I'm reading it right off the screen here. Biden issues a tweet, my message to the companies running gas stations and setting prices at the pump is simple. This is a time of war and global peril. Bring down the price you're charging at the pump to reflect the cost you're paying for the product and do it now. This is the Mussolini, you know, Biden with his tweet July 3rd. Now, what do you think the U.S. Oil and Gas Association did? Oh, they come back with a tweet. You think they would defend themselves and kiss off this dotard who's attacking them? No, here's their tweet. Working on it, Mr. President. In the meantime, have a happy 4th. And please tell the White House intern who wrote your tweet to register for Econ 101 in the fall. Now, what does that even mean? I mean, that is not a defense of your industry. And I know what they're going to be taught in. Guess what they're taught in Econ 101? they think they're taught in Econ 101 that the price system is determined by supply and demand. I wish that were true. It used to be true. But Econ 101 is just as likely to teach the students that prices are set arbitrarily, that they're set by price gougers and profiteers and Putin. The three P's, I guess. So, but again, such a crazy, the business people, even the associates, they're so apologetic and they're so craven and they're so guilt-ridden. They can't even answer a very Mussolini-type dictate from the president. Very, very disturbing.
Yeah, Richard, I saw that response kind of differently. I mean, I guess it could have been written more forcefully, but the whole tweet was in a kind of dry style. And by saying working on it, I mean, that's what companies do, right? They want to be competitive. They want to sell more product. And so they are actually, they don't need a politician to tell them to try to lower their prices, be more efficient, that they are working on it, that because that's part of how they succeed and, you know, beat the competition. Thoughts?
No, I hear you. I just right.
Thank you. Great topic. I just had a question just for clarification. It sounds like you're describing almost these two tracks where, on one hand, there are these, anti-capitalist intellectuals attacking these MBAs as these last bastion of pro-capitalists that have to be wiped out. And then on the second track, it's like those people don't even exist anymore. And they're really they are the anti-capitalists that the intellectuals want them to be. And they're, they're going, bending over backwards to prove that they're against profit or, maximizing it. I'm just curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, Scott. I guess it sounds contradictory. You know, it's like, well, are you threatened by these people, in which case they're true pro-capitalists, or they've already been converted to anti-capitalists, so don't worry about it. Just a matter of time. You could say that the totalitarian mind, which I think is going on here, the authoritarian, totalitarian, anti-capitalist mind, they don't want to see even a scintilla of a remaining respect for the shareholder. So they do think of these business schools as citadels of capitalism in a way. You're training these future bad guys. And so the pressure remains on. But no, I think you're right. I think you could say to the anti-capitalists, don't worry about it. They are generating within these MBA programs, future CEOs who will certainly help move us in the direction of it. I by the way, totally, if you know the history of this, endorse and sympathetic to the view of Ayn Rand, that at some level, business people are not really fundamentally the ones responsible for the trend. I mean, they're not the ones that are in the idea business. And they should, however, be aware of funding ideas that are pro-capitalist or not. But the real culprits here, of course, are the philosophers and political scientists and others who are, and business ethics people, I guess I would most blame, who are pushing this idea that self-interest is evil and they should be serving others. But it's a good question, Scott.
Hi, Jennifer.
Do you have a question for Richard?
Go ahead, Rashid, go ahead.
Hi, how are you, man?
Do you have a question?
I guess not.
Okay. So.
All right. Well, we'll give him the benefit of the doubt, Rashid. You're new, I can tell from your icon, and we'd love to have you back. When you come up on stage, usually it's to ask a question of the speaker. So join us next week and come up with a question. We'll invite you back up on stage. Richard, we have just four more minutes and we have a hard stop this time because I've had an interview in 30 minutes with Chris Stewart. But well, go ahead.
If you want, I could just finish off with a couple of minutes of something new. If we don't have questions.
I think we have some questions, but we're not going to have enough time to really get to them. So I'll let you put the word in there. So sorry to anyone who I'm bringing up on stage because we're wrapping up.
I just want to quickly tout, again, to try to be a little more positive here. There is a fairly decent, a somewhat mixed, but decent book by Vivek Ramaswamy. It's a long name, but Ramaswamy. Woke Inc. Woke Inc. Inside the Corporate America's Social Justice Scam. That one's worth a look. And he used to be in business, and he thinks the whole thing is terrible. And so he's a rare voice and getting some traction and getting some coverage. But also he's interesting, and I wanted to mention him because he and others are joining with Peter Thiel, who was known to the Atlas Society, to start funds and other groups to promote pushback here. So money is some money is going into movements to fight back at this. And that's very encouraging. But it started with his book. And so if you just look up Peter Thiel, T-H, I think it's E-I-L or I-E-L, right, Jennifer? They are and others are trying to contribute to a movement to defend the corporation and defend the profit motive and defend the shareholder model. So I just wanted to mention that. My own view is that the shareholder model of corporate management, and call it shareholder capitalism, is a redundancy. That's what capitalism is, at least when it comes to the corporate world. That's the only model that should be defended, the profit-maximizing shareholder model. And the opposite, stakeholder, what's called stakeholder capitalism, I think is a contradiction in terms. So that's the oxymoron. The oxymoron is stakeholder capitalism. That's the battle we're in now, and we're definitely in the minority, I think. But that's how I would frame it.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is also the frequent mantra, go woke, go broke. And so there is reality at the end of the day. And if you're doing various policies, making priorities that aren't about putting out the product that you raised money, you raised funds, you took that money from investors, that capital, in order to provide them with a return on that investment.
Yeah.
And instead, you're kind of pursuing other priorities that aren't directly funneling in to saying, hey, you gave me that money, you invested in me on the basis of the fact that I was going to earn money for you.
Yeah.
So people aren't going to loan those kinds of businesses money, and a lot of these priorities are just not popular with the general public and the customers and consumers that these companies should be catering to. So, all right. Well, thanks, Richard. This was definitely a provocative topic. Folks, I've put the link to where you can sign up to get updates from the Atlas Society so you won't miss any of these rooms. We have a couple of really great clubhouses coming up next week. As I mentioned, if you want to join me in 30 minutes, I'll be interviewing Chris Stewart. He's an activist on school choice. Also has some very interesting libertarian perspective on race and education. And I want to put a plug in for another interview I'm doing next week that I am super excited about, my favorite novelist other than Ayn Rand. I'll say my favorite thriller writer is Jack Carr. He's the author of the Terminal List series. It's currently out as a series on Amazon Prime as well. They made it into a series. So he happens to be a fan of Ayn Rand. So I'm looking forward to talking to him about his craft, about his experience as a Navy SEAL sniper, and of course the influence and the inspiration that he takes from Ayn Rand. So see you guys next week, or maybe in a half an hour. Thanks, Richard. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Jennifer, Scott, David. Thank you all.